And to sit here and take all the stuff you're telling me down, it'd take a week.
You'd have to tell me to wait.
So anyway, okay. So much for the Wilcox bunch, Ray. We want to get started.
Wilcox, no, coming back to that, you could, you know, I know four or five guys, let's say there were four guys left. If they were all together and one guy, they really felt sick. You can have a guy that, when you go towards the summit, you could make the summit. You would have very bad balance, let's say, just assume you didn't feel good going up. But on the way down, it'd be much worse off than on the way up. It'd be much harder for him to keep his balance. He could have partial cerebral edema, sorry, pressure on the brain. For his balance off.
Is that right? Is that a common thing, cerebral edema?
Cerebral.
I didn't know that. What does that consist of?
Pressure out of water.
It's the same pressure differential causing fluid lymph to.
Pulmonary edema basically is. It's water oozing out of the
cells
of the tissue into the cavities.
So that's the same thing here? In other words, water.
Yeah, water on the brain, you know, and also the brain. The brain swells, the blood vessels swell, putting more pressure. You have so much space. And very often you can have both together, cerebral edema and pulmonary edema.
It's interesting.
If you have so much, if you don't take the guy down right away,
it just gets worse.
He's going to die, and he's going to go into coma. So, just a little bit of pressure is enough for him to be way off balance, and he's all to other guys. He's going to hold them up.
It can take hours to get a guy down.
All these guys, physically, they're probably pretty exhausted, and even if you were. If you were a dozen guys, even then it's a good job. It's a job to take one or two guys down. If you just have three other guys on the road, it's not an easy job. And in the meantime, the weather is getting bad. When you're up there, you're a little bit in another world. You know, you're pretty much dependent on. On yourself.
Does the altitude ever affect you, Rick?
No, but, you know,
Well, you feel it, I imagine, but you can cope with it.
Yeah, but, no, I seem to feel pretty good. Now, I know how to cope with it, let's say, my breathing. I attach a lot of importance to the breathing. I used to do a lot of running, I just increase my breathing and I make sure that I work very hard at your altitude.
That's something I wanted to ask you. Say that the average slob went up there like me, went up at altitude like say 14,000 feet, not a high altitude. But say I went up with Sheldon to 14,000 feet or something.
Do you mean flying?
Yeah. Okay. But to say to spend some time up there. And can I by consciously breathing faster, will this help you to ward off the effects of an oxygen lack? In other words, if I say, okay, I'm going to go like this, maybe not that fast, but in other words, consciously and purposely increase the rate that I'm breathing at, will this help you out?
It depends.
You're pulling more air.
Yeah, again,
because you wouldn't have to do it consciously.
There's different ways of getting the different forms of high altitude sickness, like you said, pulmonary edema, cerebral edema, and then just cases of nausea, you know, with throw up and severe migraine headaches, something like that. But actually, the one that really is dangerous, you know, it's the pulmonary edema and cerebral edema. So you could get that. At the same time, till your water till your lungs fill up, you wouldn't maybe have too much of a problem as long as you force breathe. But the main difference would be that your blood wouldn't you wouldn't really have acclimatized. If you're climbing and you reach maybe you're getting to that altitude in 10-15 days, your blood cells will have built up to have a capacity for picking up oxygen.
Right, in other words, you're pulling more air in, but the blood isn't taking more oxygen out like it would if you were acting. I see.
So it depends, you know, if you're
if
you've been doing this a lot. And of course, the idea is for your body to use little oxygen, not need too much. Therefore, if you're in excellent physical condition, your heart still not beating too fast, you know. But if it's when you're running here and it's beating extremely fast, well, you can imagine what happens up there. So by being in good physical condition, it will make it so you don't need so much oxygen to start.
Well, look at when they found the bodies with the helicopter. Then what happened? In other words, they went up and located. How long did they fly?
The pilot and I went up.
Oh, that's what I mean. Okay,
We flew right over the summit and we started flying horizontally, side to side, and losing altitude. Looking, and then when we reached around 15.5 or so, I noticed little dots. Wasn't sure it was a pilot turn around and fly close, and it was part of the body sticking out of the snow. They were all together, it seemed.
How far did they fall?
Well, it's hard to tell. They hadn't marked their route. All I could tell was that they had used one or two wands on the main route above. And going back to their camp down in the northeast fork, we found a lot of wands. So they had neglected to take a lot of mountain wands with them.
Were they fairly experienced?
Oh, yeah.
The crew in general?
You know, they probably were. You know, but that's experience. You know, you learn every day. You know? And
they were training for the Himalayas.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
In other words, this was sort of a training mission.
They were in group.
But, you know, experience very often tends to make you more careless, you know, so it doesn't really count to
what you gain, it detracts from it.
Yeah.
You might gain a little, but you lose if you get careless.
Especially if you're climbing with a bunch of friends, as opposed to the way I'm leading expeditions. There I can assume full responsibility, and at the same time I impose full control over the whole expedition. Because I'm not climbing with friends.
You don't have to listen to
somebody telling me, oh hell, let's not do that. We don't need to take these precautions. I'm responsible. I'm going to run it the way I want.
If you're
going with a bunch of friends, you know, pretty nobody's really responsible. If two guys get killed or so, nobody gets the blame for it. You know, it's just one of those things. Everybody assumes that mountain climbing is dangerous. You know, so automatically.
But not with the Japanese girls, you know. They really blame each
other. Well, they're
even
made their
own
team.
Even though they were first going together. Well, the parents of these girls told her not to come back unless they brought.
Yeah, what was the deal with that anyway? That's what Don said too. Now he explained it.
It was really upsetting.
But why did this happen? In other words,
she got sick, so she stayed behind, I guess.
She had a perforated ulcer, I think.
I don't know.
That's what Don said. That's what Don said. It turned out to be.
I remember reading
it.
Well,
she was sick on the ridge.
She was up on the mountain.
And then one of the the other girl was still down below.
Left
the other girl
behind too.
Yeah.
But at a different
camp. The three girls went up.
At a different camp.
And whether they ever made the summit or They probably made the summit, and then on the way down, bad weather set in, you know, the whiteout, and they probably lost the trail. That's probably the way it looked like. They probably lost the trail. You have to stay, I don't know the ridge, so. And they could have walked off, they walked a little bit too far to the west there, and then probably one stumbled or so, and everybody being a little slow, a little sluggish, you know, nobody was able to arrest her, and you pull the second one. So, you know, once you have two guys going, so three guys on the rope is not too good, you know, it's better than two.
Yeah.
But it's maybe worse than one. It's maybe worse than just one guy on a rope. If one guy is by himself, he falls.
Yeah,
he doesn't have to worry about anybody behind, and he has a chance to arrest himself or not, you know. But so you should always have as many people as possible.
Well, here again, Sheldon said, well, now, I don't mean to sound like I'm trying to play what you say against Sheldon. Don't get me wrong. But and Don, you know, freely admits he's just supposing, you know.
You're right. Yeah.
And you are too, actually. So,
but
exactly. This is why I'm asking you this thing. In other words, this is why I say, well, you know, were they panicked? See? Because Sheldon infers that he thought probably what happened, they got up there, it was blowing real hard, and there was some bad weather. They were in the bad weather. They didn't have any equipment with them. And apparently there was another outfit up there that tried to talk them out of going the last 500-600 feet.
Yeah.
And Sheldon's idea is that they made the summit. Well, he found their expedition flag, didn't he? On the summit?
Somebody else.
Or somebody did?
When we went up, our expedition that we went up after,
you found it?
Up there.
Okay. So anyway, they did make the summit. But what Sheldon assumes happens, they made the summit, realized, you know, that they were in a very precarious position, and they didn't have any gear with them, and it was really starting to blow, and a little whiteout on. So they headed down, and a combination of things. Well, he felt that probably what happened, they panicked. He said that they had a choice between a 5,000-foot and a 3,000-foot descent. And they took the 3,000-foot descent. What he meant there, I don't know. But
well,
I thought he meant there's two camps.
Well, they were looking right down, apparently. And that's another thing Don said, looking where they were, where they fell. He said another 1,000 feet and they would have put near landed on his 14,300-foot airstrip.
Yeah, right.
But in other words, what he
that's
said, very likely what
down.
They could have, what they did, right. They were standing up there and they looked down and here's the tent down there. Don said there was an orange tent on the 14,300-foot level. And he figures that it was a severely steep grade that they had.
They couldn't see that from the summit.
No, but from the ridge.
From the ridge, see. And so he figures that they said, man, let's go down this. It's shorter in the face of the fact that it was very steep.
Yeah.
They could see the tent, and so they figured, let's get down there rather than go apparently the 5,000 feet to their own camp. This is, I think, what the thing was.
How could they lose their way? You know, they'd have to start down the wrong direction in order to get over there.
Yeah, I don't think altitude wasn't any different. I don't think they were still starting there.
Well, no, he meant the distance, I think, more than altitude when he said 5,000 feet to there. Well, maybe not. Though. Anyway, the point was that Don thought that they were panicked. In other words, they wanted to get down off of there quick. This being evident in the fact that they chose the shorter but steeper and therefore more dangerous route, knowingly. In other words, he assumed they were trying to get down the quickest way possible to the camp at 14,300 feet where he landed his airplane. This was his assumption, you know. And that they started down that steep grade, which is one he says a guy could almost literally parachute down. And the guy that skied solo ski. Anyway, and he said they fell. And he claims that if they fell from the top, they would have fallen in the equivalent of about 4,000 feet to where they were.
Well, the top, from where it started, the top is way over on the other side. So there you actually have it's 19.6 or so, you know, it's quite a few hundred feet below the summit. And it comes away from the summit on down to Cahuilc Na Horn, where they would have started on.
Well, what would you, just guessing now, if
Cahuilc
they had...
Cahuilc Na Horn is 19.6, so they would have walked from there down to 14.6 to the West Butler's camp instead of going down the ridge.
Right, okay. Right, that's what he said. But they didn't. Or at least where they fell wasn't in that direction.
No, the thing is, what may have happened is that they didn't mark the route with the wands, you know.
Well, they hadn't even come that route, you know.
Well, that's what I'm talking about.
So how could they mark it?
Mark the route on their own
they
way.
Yeah, but if you're standing on the summit, you start going a completely different direction.
No, that's
altogether.
The way for them to go.
It is?
Oh, sure. The top of the direct, West Butler's direct, comes out of Cahuilc Na Horn around over there.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. So coming back, you would still come down that way, and then mm-hmm. you would go down here, and here's the big basin of the 14.5, mm-hmm. you know, where the West Butler's was mm-hmm. this way. Now,
and where did they
it would
come
be hard,
from?
They probably got screwed up getting back on the ridge.
So in other words, what you're saying
come
is...
Come up the
there?
Ridge, yeah.
Over there.
So in other words, what you're saying is they, in effect, got lost coming back.
Probably, because we've done the same thing, you know. And
now, it was blowing snow, though, wasn't it, Ray? I mean, it was
bad. You can have even nice weather around, and if
right.
you have
and
local...
And you can't see 5 feet.
The lenticular cloud that you have there.
This is what I'm saying.
The lenticular cloud you have
right.
there.
Right. Look, I got to say something. I got to ascribe some reason for why they fell. Either they had panicked and ran off the edge of it, which is Sheldon's theory, or else I've got to go the route where they were blundering around up there, not really panicked, but they got lost because they didn't pick it their way and just fell off the thing, one of the two.
We've been up there when we wanded fairly close and had to stand and peer and look for the wands, you know, for like 5 minutes
just sit
at
down
a time.
Sure,
right.
I can see that.
You know,
I can see that.
See a
you bet.
Thing.
One thing for the panicking end of it, the altitude makes you a little sluggish, you know. And the reason probably a lot of people get killed at altitude is because maybe they don't panic enough. Mm-hmm. They get sluggish, they get, they don't really get too nervous about anything.
Right.
So it's not too often you're going to, on the contrary, you can take a guy who is affected by altitude, you can walk him right over to the edge, and if you wanted to kill him, you tell him, go ahead, you'll be fine. He'll walk on out. I've seen guys come on down saying, I'm fine, dropping the ice axes and just
the pack falling
completely.
Off their back and they're
that's
where
the,
like,
that's
where
the
oh,
leader,
I feel fine.
That's where the leader has to act like a bloody maniac. And,
like Cartier, remember?
You know, swing the ice axe and, you know, really try to shake them up.
Right, keep them motivated.
They're so sluggish.
Yeah.
And that's what altitude does
and
to you.
They don't even realize that they're bad.
You become very, very unemotional.
Yeah.
You know, except the guy who wants to get some results, you have to scream. You know, you have to.
Yeah.
You have to do something.
Hypoxia. You know, everything's great.
Yeah.
Like you're drunk.
So, I'm pretty sure that. I mean, one way or another, they got lost.
Okay.
And they may have realized. Maybe partway down this other side that they were on the wrong side, and maybe they might have wanted to go down to this other
Okay, why don't I write it this way? I say, Sheldon, who was in the air all the time, obviously, he wasn't on the ground, you know, he was flying, and in retrospect, he felt that they may have panicked, but Janae thinks differently, because this, and this, what you just said. I think that's the best way to do it.
Yeah, I mean,
because, you know, they're both,
who knows,
both theories. And honestly, Ray, I'd much, much rather go along with yours, you know. In fact, I may not even put the panic thing in there.
The best thing, and where you can do some good, is to let people know that it's very important mm-hmm. that you wand your out.
Right.
It's like having a lifeline behind you. Not, you know, if you go on a beautiful day and you don't mark your route, it's like you're cutting a bunch of bridges behind you. You have, whatever you do on the mountain, you have to do it with in mind the worst possible conditions in the time to come. The way you climb for the summit. You're trying to achieve the goal. You're not trying, you know you're going to achieve the goal. But all through your action, every action, you should always keep in mind that you can never be sure of anything. You cannot say, I know what the weather is going to be today. I know how far I'm going today. You don't know. You never want to make a plan to which you're tied to. Because so many things can come up. Weather conditions, individuals in an expedition, you have maybe 12 guys in an expedition. Each one of them might maybe react a certain way that you don't want to be tied to a plan so that you cannot act safely for him and for the whole of the expedition. So the thing to point out there is that they made a mistake by not warning them out.
Right.
Now you can't necessarily blame them because they've never climbed that way, you see.
Sure, right.
No, I'm just talking in generality.
Sure.
Alpine climbers, Japanese climbers, European climbers, very often are not at all familiar with warning methods, you know, with marking you out. They are good weather climbers. They are weekend climbers, you know. They run up with their provisions for the day for 2-3 days and then they run back down. And
well, that's what they were doing.
And
they didn't take any gear with them.
You know, it's a different way of climbing. They're always optimistic, you see. It's fine to be optimistic, but be prepared for the worst, you know. And
so
that's the big difference.
Yeah.
You know, you can see it actually from the way people climb in Europe, the way they climb in Japan. In Europe, you get an average of 400-500 people killed every summer. Of course, you have a lot of people climbing. But
is that right?
Sure. In Chamonix alone, on the Mont Blanc Massif, I don't think you ever get lower than 100 a year or so getting killed there, you know?
Yeah.
Because
They're
fanatic climbers, so, you know, and they're almost suicide bent. You know, I don't want to do that kind of climbing. I enjoy life, you know, I like expeditions. And this technical climbing, where you're climbing in areas where there's a lot of rock fall, you know, and it doesn't appeal to me that much, heck, well, you know, because your chances of getting killed are just too great, you know. If you need to do it one time for a specific reason, fine, you know, but not as a habit. Going every weekend, taking those chances is stupid because your mind gets used to getting by with it, to get, you know, everybody else around you gets killed, but you're safe.
You figure you're invincible.
Yeah, and, you know, I don't know.
On expeditions, you can pit yourself against the dangers, but if you're just going in an avalanche,
you wouldn't particularly want to go up Huntington then.
Oh, I don't say I wouldn't, sure.
But I mean, it's not the type of climb that you would want to do.
Well, a ridge or so, but the way they're doing it in Europe, just because sometimes you might have a part of a face coming down a rock slide or so. Pretty soon you have somebody there climbing this route because it's never been climbed before, because it's just a new route now, you know.
Well, that's what Washburn said, you know. It went from first climbs to dangerous climbs on McKinley, even when they were first, you know, like in the 50s.
Yeah.
It went from.
But here it's still new. It's
not.
People don't really worry too much.
Well, anyway, Ray, they fell. All three of them. They were roped together. How far would you estimate they fell vertically? Again, it's a guess because you don't know exactly.
Well, where they were was where they slowed down. It wasn't steep where they were. So that's where the bodies.
Yeah, right. I realize that.
And some of them had lost shoes, you know, tumbling down. So they went for a good. Probably came down a couple of thousand feet anyway.
But it wasn't a free fall. It was a rolling fall.
Tumbling, but just as bad.
So then you spotted them from the plane, from the helicopter.
Yeah.
And then what did you do beyond that?
Had our expedition up on a glacier already going up, and So instead of landing at the usual landing place, since Chiquita and Watanabe
yeah.
here, they wanted to come up there too, which I wasn't too crazy about, but anyway, I said, okay.
Yeah, he wasn't much of a climber, was he, from what...
Well, he hadn't been on the climb, you know.
But I'm right, but I mean, he came, he was... The reason I asked this is, you know, here's the guy, he's the husband of one of the gals that got killed, and he's looking for her.
Yeah, but the area wasn't dangerous where we were going.
I realize that.
Questioning to go from 10,000 to 14,000.
Yeah.
There we're going to fly back out. So,
Now, where were they? They were at 10,000 when you found
them? The bodies were at 15,500. And then
15,500.
So we went, I asked the park to let us fly in at 10,000 since they wanted to come in too. So I joined our team. We joined our team. By the time we joined them, they were at 14. I had an expedition. So we joined them there, and then we went on up and got the bodies there.
That's the big plateau.
That's the last place where Sheldon lands.
Yeah,
so we went up there.
Yeah. How many guys went now? You, Marlene, and Watanabe?
To go after the bodies?
Yeah, did Machiko
no,
say
we took, quite a few guys.
Was that
half a dozen or so, yeah.
And they were out of your crew?
Yeah, yeah, my expedition.
So in other words, there was yourself, Marlene,
no,
I
you didn't go.
She stayed at the camp.
Oh, I see, okay.
14.
So, there was
Michiko,
yourself,
Watanabe,
Machiko, Sakita. That's three.
Sumner, Carti, a few others.
How does Carti spell it?
C-A-R-T-E.
There
were several.
And several Roots. Others, we'll say. It's not
Roots.
Important.
Yeah.
There were quite a few.
Well,
there was about three guys. Oh, more than that.
More
yeah.
Than that.
Just three guys per body, probably.
To pull them down.
So we had to untangle them first, you know.
So you climbed up there from 10,000.
No, from 14. Yeah, from 10 we went to 14. Joined our expedition.
14, right, joined your
and
expedition.
From 14, I could see the spot where the bodies were.
Had Sheldon taken you guys in there originally at 14?
No.
No, he threw us in at 10.
The two Japanese.
But they climbed to 14, your expedition.
But they had gone there before
yeah.
already.
Yeah,
see, we just joined them. Because I was supposed to.
Right, I realize that, but I'm saying that Sheldon flew them into 10. They went to 14.
No.
Ooh, your expedition.
No, we landed outside the park.
Oh, I see.
The way
uh-huh,
expeditions
I
always do.
Oh, right.
And they've been
right,
gone
okay.
about
yeah,
you know
right
a week.
The park boundary.
A week, and then Janae and me and Michiko and Watanabe
okay.
flew into 10.
What I'm getting at is this though: the expedition that you had up there that you were going to join when this is all over.
Yeah.
They. Had started out where? At 7 on a hill?
Yeah, on the southeast
okay.
fork.
Did Sheldon climb in there?
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. And they had gone, in your absence, from 7,000 on the Kahiltna up to 14,000.
Right.
300 to his strip.
And then we caught them at 14.
Right. Okay. So then, I'm just doing this to kind of get it fixed
yeah.
in my mind. Okay. So then, Machiko, or the three Japanese girls fell, possibly 2,000 feet or what? Ended up at 15,500 from where they fell.
They might have fallen more, you know, it's
yeah,
hard,
it's hard
to
tell. But that's where you found them, at 15,500.
Up to 3,000 feet, you know. They,
yeah.
If they fell right around Archdeacon's Tower, they could have fallen...
Well, Sheldon said 4,000.
4,000 feet, yeah.
Okay, so then you found them, and you went to...
We took them down.
No, but what I'm trying to get fixed in my mind is now, when you after you found them with a helicopter, then you went to 10?
No, I came back into Anchorage.
Back into Anchorage.
I mean, back to Talkeetna with the helicopter.
Okay.
And I was going to go in there anyway,
right,
see?
Right.
I knew I had to join my expedition,
right. Okay.
So I just... And then Michiko and Watanabe decided
okay,
to come
okay,
along.
I see it now.
Then we went in with 12,
okay.
one plane load to 10,000.
Okay. And then you
landed at 10,000, so we wouldn't have to, you know,
right,
didn't
right.
want to run the whole with these two guys, you know.
The Super Cub, it had taken you four or five trips to get before.
Just
three,
right. No, usually we land outside the park boundary, but since we had them with us, I asked the park permission to land at 10,000, you know.
Okay, I got you. So
he could have landed at 14, but I figured it would be better with 10 if they acclimatized a little bit.
Right. Okay, so now, you went in with him at that time?
Yeah.
10.
Okay,
four of us.
So there was you, Watanabe, Machiko Sakita, and Marty. Okay. You went in with Sheldon in the 180, and that was a supercharged 180, which is a new airplane. Because he mentioned that in his relating to it. You went to 10,000, and you got out there and you headed to 14.3 before. Okay, you get to 14.3, then you met up with your group. We were waiting for you there. And there was 8 or 10 of you went up the mountain. You didn't go, you stayed at 10,000. And you went up
14,000.
All right, 14. And then you went from 14 to 15.5, so you had 14.3, so you had what, 1,200 feet?
Yeah, it wasn't very
far.
Okay.
You know?
It wasn't any.
So, but you took enough guys to make the job feasible to bring them back.
Yeah.
You untangled them, dug them out of the snow, untangled them as best you can. Now, how do you carry a guy like that?
The best thing is to take plastic.
Accios?
No.
Viscreen.
Viscreen, all of the viscreen is slide very easily.
Yeah, right. So you drag them on this group.
If you have somebody who breaks a leg or so, you want to put them in the sleeping bag and you just hope that the sleeping bag uses. You can just drag the sleeping bag on the ground. If it's deep enough, you don't want it to be very slippery, you see, because it's sliding as it is.
So you got them back to 14.3.
Yeah, we left them at the head of the bowl there, so Sheldon could pick them up there. We clamped out a runway. We laid down the. See, I had still to run an expedition, so I pointed out to Watanabe and Michiko where the airstrip had to be, so we let them clamp down the airstrip, right?
Just the two of them.
Yeah.
Now, how long was it between the time? Okay, now, but what happened then? You got the bodies back down to 14,300, and you left Watanabe, the husband of one of the gals that had died, and Michiko Sakita at 14.3 with snowshoes to pack down the runway.
See, we got,
because
we didn't worry too much about him because we could keep an eye on him anyway.
Watch him from
right up to 17,000, you know, we can see them down there. You know,
so then you guys lit out.
Yeah.
Now, how long were you there after you came back? Or after you got the bodies back? How long did you stick around?
Let's say it slowed the expedition down about one day.
Well, I mean,
did we stay overnight or did we go right on?
We send them up there, remember, and they came on back. We were going to catch up later. They came back for the afternoon. The big line, the one that's pictured with the big line.
But was that the very same day we brought the bodies down and sent them up? The whole group up?
I'm pretty sure. Because we went up there next month.
So, in other words, you got, what time of day was it when you got back with the bodies?
Midday.
And then, was that when you sent the rest of your expedition up, or did you send them before you left to go get the bodies?
And then took them up.
Probably rested a little bit, and then, but they came back because it started snowing, and it was easier to come back to the 14,000 camp.
But you didn't go with them.
Stuck at 16
at that point.
You stayed with Michiko Sakita, and
we stayed with them that day.
Okay, that's what I'm getting at.
Then the next morning, we all took
Okay, that's right. Okay. And then Sheldon came in when? The next day?
No, I don't really know exactly when.
Okay, well, I've got that on the tape,
probably
I think.
Probably a couple of days.
Yeah,
so
I'm sure that he told me, you know, how long it was between
the two. I radioed him. And I always carry a portable radio. Mm-hmm.
Weren't we?
We were at 17.
We watched him come in, and it. He went way down. We thought he'd probably be stuck because he stopped the plane down toward the end of the runway or something. You remember that?
We watched him from 17,000.
We thought he wouldn't be able to take off. Remember? He landed kind of funny on the runway. And there was nobody to push him.
Probably he wasn't on the runway.
Yeah, or something weird. But anyway, it worked out. We were afraid
you tramp a runway for a whole bloody day and then you land beside the runway because you don't like the runway.
That makes you feel good, eh?
Okay.
work your head off the whole day.
I'd rather climb a mountain than trample a runway. More work to trample a runway, I swear.
I can imagine a tremendous job at altitude. At altitude, you know.
You want some tea, you guys?
Oh, I got some. She's not much of a tea drinker. I like tea. So, okay, well, that pretty well gives me a thing. Maybe
then they came back with...
Don't even forget to look at them pictures.
Okay. Yeah, now, the thing on the... You were talking about money before. From what I heard, I don't know if this is true, but somebody said that Michiko was supposed to pay back all the costs of the rescue and everything. Is that true? Or
what? That's what Sheldon said. He says that what happened was that they were
everything?
Well, I don't know who was supposed to get paid.
The helicopter?
But she was in for the tune of $3,000. And she had to pay it, or they weren't going to let her back in the country. And she had, you know, uh-huh. used all of her money in trying to going to Anchorage and this type of thing. And so, what
who
the
back there spend their money on rescuer?
Know.
No, no, I don't think that part. I think maybe I have to pay it with our wages and stuff.
Yeah.
Somebody out there?
No, I just bumped along. But anyway, what happened was that Sheldon wrote his bill on. Which I thought was pretty nice.
Yeah.
I mean, this is one of the things, one of the main things that I think makes this a tremendous thing for the last chapter in the book, you know. Because I've known him.
No, he does a lot of time, you know.
And
boy, he's a good head
like
when it comes to like something like
Duo's,
that.
Duo's right. House burned down over here,
last
you know.
Summer,
sure.
He's real busy in the fall anyway, you know. And running into all kinds of hassles because people are waiting. Even then, he took all his stuff up there.
Lumber and stuff up there.
He flew $400-$500 worth of trips up there, you know.
Remember the day
he was didn't charge
there with
him.
No.
Took somebody else to get a moose for
whose
him.
Whose house was that?
Well, Durr.
Durr's, D-U-R-R.
Up at Chase.
D-U-R-R-E-A-U-X?
No, D-U-R-R.
Durr.
Oh, Durr. I see. Up at Chase.
Up
right on the railroad or off the railroad?
Some of the boys who live up there, then they worked for us last summer.
Oh, were they the guys who went up to hook the cabin back down? Oh, worked for you. I got you. Uh-huh. Okay.
Oh, no, you know, I have my disagreements with him and fights, you know. I fly off the handle pretty fast anyway. But, he's pretty good.
Well, listen, when you guys went up and got Bullard, that was a whole different ballgame, wasn't it?
Who was he? He
was an anatomist, and he was from Indiana University.
He fell in the crevasse. He was on the Petzold
expedition. Oh,
just
that.
Oh,
yeah.
30 guys,
no
30 guys on the expedition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 30, well, it was 30, more than that. There was 33, supposedly.
Yeah, they were with, what bugs me about those guys is that they call themselves non-profit organization, you know, and I'm supposed to be a profit organization making lots of money, you know.
Pay taxes.
Yeah, they call themselves non-profit, National Outdoor Leadership School.
Yeah.
That's who he was with.
Yeah, Wyoming. Yeah, Bullard. I kept thinking, well, this guy is French, you know, because, you know, you can...
I don't even know how...
B-O-U-L-L-A-R-D. Sure, it's B-U-L-L-A-R-D.
What did you call
Robert
it?
Robert A. Bullard.
B-U-L-L-A-R-D.
Bullard. Got to be pronounced that way. He's no more French than I am.
Yeah.
Huh?
Yeah.
I talked to Morris up at the university.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, he looked it up in a book.
Oh,
sure, I know who he is. Got killed up on the glacier and so on and so on.
He was from the university?
No, he was from Indiana.
The guy was walking on the campus from
Indiana University in Bloomington. His name was Robert A. Bullard. He's 42 years old. And he's 6'4" and he weighed 235 pounds and he fell 150 feet right on his head.
I'll get you to the crevasse.
Jesus,
we didn't pull him out. He was pulled out.
Oh, that's right.
He
I mean, but when they pulled him out,
Yeah.
Boy, 150 foot, man. He fell on the shelf, didn't he? There again, Sheldon said he fell in a closing crevasse. Now, I visualize, what is a closing? Yeah, a closing crevasse is just one that tapers down to nothing. But now, then I read in the newspaper that he fell onto a shelf.
I don't know.
In the microphone.
No,
yeah, but, right, but you know. Yeah. There again,
you're talking
you're
about
him in the book, you might
if
as
you
well
fall, if the guy fell 150 feet in this type of a crevasse, you wouldn't get him out.
That's
that's about right.
It happens quite a bit.
I thought of that myself.
In Europe, you know, they've had guys that tried to pull out with helicopters and everything too, you know.
Jesus.
So now they have a...
You must have fallen on the shelf.
You have to pee on him to throw the ice around.
That's
him.
That right?
Oh, no. But, yeah. In Chamonix, they have a helicopter equipped with water tanks with hot. They put hot water in there, and he
really
goes over, hovers over, and sprinkles water all around.
Do
the guy.
Really?
Oh,
they've right. lost so many guys, so they have one set up. I don't know if they used it yet. But last time I was there, that's what they had.
Wow.
So many guys have fallen in there, and they couldn't get them out.
Can't you chop them out?
No, no space.
How can you get down in there?
And the body, you wedge yourself.
You fall 100 feet and then hit the ice and get driven down in there, man, you're falling, what, 100 feet?
The air is knocked out from you and you're, the body heat melts
right.
a nice little shape, so you wedge yourself even better.
And then
you
expand. You know, you
and
as you melt it, you relax like this.
Yeah.
And then the body heat leaves, you know, you start
exactly.
to get hypothermia. And, you know, you're in
a regular frozen cocoon down there.
The nice warm shower, you know, and then pull, try to make it a little slippery on him.
But Bird,
the ice
they had him out, didn't they? They had him out of the
ice. We landed there. And I was just getting ready to go on another expedition. That was in 70.
Where were you going?
I was going on McKinley.
No, that wasn't 70.
No, that was
71.
Boy, why am I getting stuck at 70?
Well,
wasn't
when
you,
here.
You were here?
71.
Okay. 80 after Titus.
71
no,
or
I mean, 70. During Titus.
It might even been 72.
During Titus. Dude, that don't sound 80. Good, Marlene.
It was either 71 or 72.
Well, we had the large expedition. Well, probably when Crossing was here.
What was the... Well, of course, Bullard was on McKinley. Bullard was on McKinley. But you had another expedition up on the mountain.
Well, no, we were still here.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, Sheldon, came back here and off you went.
Mm-hmm. Oh, the expedition was still waiting for you here. Until
you got ready to go.
And that was another McKinley, the one you were going on.
That was 71.
Yeah.
Oh. Well, did Petzold have a group
in 71?
In 72?
No, Bullard was in 71.
Okay.
In 71, that's when he had three of them. Nobody made a sermon.
Bullard fell in there when? July?
Yeah, I think
beginning
July,
of July.
I was probably
definitely
was there.
71. I know that.
I was probably was due to leave the 1st of July. That is? Thank you.
Mm-hmm. This is that brown Schwager?
What is it?
Brown Schweigen.
Your culture.
Boy, is that good.
Anyway.
What kind of sausage is that?
Liver.
Well, I know, but I mean, what make?
Swiss Colony?
Swiss Colony, they package that.
We
also
buy that in Anchorage?
We also buy fondue from them, you know. Cheese fondue.
You know.
Oh, I see.
You know, they make
all
kinds of cheese.
No wonder that's good cheese.
Swiss Colony, they have little stores called Swiss Colony in Anchorage.
Well, they've got them in Anchorage.
Penny Mall, they had one.
The last time I was down there, I went over there, it was cold.
Yeah, they keep going out of business.
That's why I brought you that cheese.
Well, I'd like to get about 2 dozen of those Braunschweigers. Boy, is that good.
And those banana flakes, too.
That's better than that stuff I buy. That's excellent. I come from Milwaukee, Ray. That's my home, Wisconsin.
Really?
Me too.
Germans. No kidding, Marlene. Are you from Milwaukee? Oh, from Madison.
Yeah.
Well, how do you know?
My sister lives in Milwaukee.
Huh. Whereabouts?
Berlin?
New Berlin? That's not Milwaukee, that's a town.
Well, I know, but it's
I mean,
Milwaukee.
It's like 30 miles.
Yeah.
Yeah, I haven't seen anybody from Iowa floating around up here yet. You get some guy, popcorn king or something.
My dad used to live in
Iowa. The day they start raising hogs on McKinley, then you'll see some guys from Iowa up here. Feed him that moss up there, right?
Next time my dad brings some sweet corn, don't get any.
Boy, he brought a suitcase of fresh sweet corn.
Picked
it in the morning, flew up here, and we had some in the evening. Was that ever good?
Wow.
Oh, man.
I love
great big ears. They're cob about that big around, you know, and the ears are about that big around. Yeah, huge thing. Oh, really great.
He takes home
clothes
and family.
Yeah, he takes some fish back with him. He likes the family. Well, that was good. That really clears up a lot of stuff. It gives me a lot of material.
Gets you more confused.
No. Not by a long shot. See, Sheldon can't give me, or he didn't give me, any kind of a description. He just said, well, Ray was there and they went up and got him. Well, you know, you can't.
We have to deal up
like you've got to give a little detail, you know. This is great.
But you know,
the kid that was killed up there.
Jettinger?
Yeah, Jettinger.
You went up on that, didn't you?
That's
I'm not going to write that in the book.